This is Extraordinary Lives, a podcast from Lad Bible where we speak to people with a unique story to tell. A warning that this episode contains discussion of sexual violence and abuse, and discussion of suicidal feelings which you may find distressing. I'm Ben Powell Jones, and coming up in this episode...
So I got my A-level results after being raped the night before in one of the exams. I'd written a suicide note rather than actually do the exam.
Hi, I'm Ben Powell Jones. Welcome to this episode of Extraordinary Lives from Lad Bible. I'm sitting here today with Kate Alicia. Great to have you, Kate. Would you mind just introducing yourself?
My name's Kate Alicia and I'm a grooming gang survivor and a qualified mental health nurse.
So obviously the topics that we're going to talk about today are very, very dark and upsetting. And if anything's asked in a way that you feel uncomfortable with or you'd like rephrasing or anything like that, please just do let me know. So for anyone listening that might not be completely clear, what is a grooming gang?
While I was being abused, I didn't really see them as a gang. Mm. They were some people on the street who were actually neighbours of mine. Mm. The way they behaved was in a gang-like fashion. Mm. So they were an organised crime gang already, but they also engaged in the rape and exploitation of young girls.
I understand. And what we're here to talk about today is your very unpleasant experiences with that gang. Where did it start for you? You know, when you say that they were an organised crime gang that were your neighbours, did you grow up in that kind of area? Did you grow up in like a rough neighbourhood and that was natural, or was it something you moved into?
No, so I grew up like elsewhere, not too far away really. Mm. But I moved out of home when I was 18. Mm-hmm. I know that a lot of the sort of typical what you would think of a grooming gang victim would be somebody who's come from a broken home.
Okay.
But they work on your vulnerabilities, and some people may have come from a difficult upbringing, but my vulnerabilities were slightly different to that. So I moved out of home when I was 18 because my house was becoming quite crowded, and I was old enough to move out, so it wasn't really seen as a big issue. Mm-hmm. So I left home and I moved to the town where I was actually doing my A-levels, which was in Telford. And because I'd been there, I was in my second year of college, so I'd been going to that town every day for the last year and a half, and it looked like quite a nice place to live. Mm-hmm. So I did end up moving to supported living for teenagers between the age of 18 and 25. Because that was supported, it's supported accommodation. So it seemed, that also seemed to be the best place for somebody as young as I was while I was still at college. It just happened that the road that I was living on, that I moved into, was dominated by a particular gang. Mm-hmm. You've heard of like gangs having sort of postcode wars. Mm-hmm. So the street that I moved into had a gang on it, which I didn't understand. I didn't know anything about. I was only 18 and I'd only just moved home, so there was a lot that I didn't know about the world. I was kind of very naive and sort of blind to actually what was going on the street.
Was the street itself, when you moved there, did it feel like a dangerous street or did it feel like a normal street in the middle of a town?
Probably in hindsight, you might have seen groups of people or groups of men or young people on the street that actually were part of a gang, but you don't want to make that assumption about everyone that you walk past. And it had a little park at the end of it, and it was only a short road, and it was the road that I'd walked through at lunchtimes to get my lunch between college and the town centre. Mm. So it honestly looked like quite a little bright street, really, with trees on it, and you know, wouldn't even think anything of it, I don't think.
Okay. So at the moment, you're a normal student living a normal life with accommodation that's been sort of subsidised by the college, is that right?
I think it was subsidised by the government, really.
Right.
I think it
to
was
help.
The council, rather.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
And so at what point did you start to fraternise with people that you would later realise were a gang?
I was introduced to them by accident because, technically I was fairly, mature for my age, really. Mm. And I wouldn't have hung out with them by choice. So I kind of fell into it by accident. And I think it was really through me being thinking of myself as a kind person. So when I first moved into the YMCA, I wanted to make friends with the other young people in the YMCA. So I wasn't trying to make friends with every neighbour, but my next door neighbour that was in the flat next to mine, and the neighbour who was on the other side of the block of flats to mine, I made friends with them, and they seemed quite okay. You know, they were same age as me. They were like the same sort of people that I would meet at college.
Yeah.
It started off well, to be fair. I was friends with one of the girls, and then I was friends with one of the boys, who is William. We had a little group of three of us. And then I had some friends that I worked with in my part-time job, and we all started hanging out together, and there was about a group of five of us in total. And all of that seemed absolutely fine. And it was William who had some other friends. And really, I think that he had come from a broken home, or something had, like he'd had more difficult upbringing. And he went to a different college to us, and it was called NACRO. And I didn't realise at the time, because I didn't know anything about anything. Mm-hmm. but NACRO is for children who have, it's a school for children who have behavioural difficulties and may or may not have a criminal record.
Okay.
So he wasn't evil. He was just vulnerable like we were. And I think we put too much responsibility on boys to be more responsible of the girls that they're with. But really, I just think that he'd got mixed up in the gang, probably because he was either taking drugs or they'd coerced him into selling drugs, which I don't know. I'm just speculating. He was friends with them, and I don't feel like it was necessarily by choice. I think they were quite pushy with him. They used to use his flat for using like dealing drugs or what he described as having sex with other girls. So mm-hmm. They would use his flat because they couldn't use their own house, or that was their excuse. Mm-hmm. And at the time it didn't sound right, but you know, to begin with, we didn't know at all. Mm-hmm. As sort of weeks go on of being friends with someone, they open up a bit more. Mm-hmm. And he starts telling us these things are a bit odd. So that's, that's how I ended up meeting these other people on the street that were members of gangs through William, through being friends with William. Mm-hmm.
You met these other members that lived on the street through William, and it sounds like they were exploiting him when you say they're using his flat to do things, to deal drugs and things like that. How did you begin to get more involved with them?
Mm. I was having some difficulties with them. William had, so he would sell his phone to cash converters to buy drugs or to, I don't know, maybe to live on, for money to live on. And then he would buy his phone back at the end of the month when he got paid again.
Right.
And while he didn't have a mobile phone, he was giving my number out without permission as a way of getting in touch with him. So people started calling me to say, is William there? And I'd be like, and then they would be calling me for other reasons. If I said William's not there, then they'd be trying to make conversation with me over the phone.
Okay.
And that's how they kind of got to hear of me. I don't know if William had talked to them. If he had, I think it would have, it wouldn't have been in a malicious way. It would have been in an innocent way. So perhaps he told them that he fancied me or that he liked me in some way, or I've met this girl and I like her. And they, because they were actually using him and taking advantage of him, they wanted to have one up on him by getting his girl or the girl that he fancied, if that makes sense. So there was a male dominant thing going on between him and them at the time. And that's how they ended up getting, they got my attention, or I got their attention.
Yeah. You sort of came into the radar, like,
yeah.
And what was the, if you don't mind me asking, and you're happy to say, what was the first incident?
So, I mean, William had mentioned that Shamil was getting out of prison. I didn't know who Shamil was. It was the first time anybody had mentioned his name. Mm. He wasn't on the street, so I hadn't even seen him around because he was in prison. Mm. And it was kind of word on the street, and they sort of told me things about him, but I didn't really know who he was. And then the first time when he did get out of prison, I was warned as well to avoid him. So I was absolutely, to be honest, terrified. I didn't know any criminals, and I didn't really want to know any criminals.
Did you know what he was in prison for?
I'd heard lots of different things.
Wow, okay.
But they were all violent. Right. So, whether it was because he had broken somebody's jaw, a stranger in the street, he said he'd beaten up somebody, said he'd been beaten up somebody, stranger in the street, broken their jaw, they were in hospital. And then I heard that he'd broken into somebody's house with a knife. Obviously, those things are completely different. So I don't know which one is which, whether either of them were true, but it sounded like it was something violent anyway. And when the first time I met him, I didn't realize this was Shamil that everybody was talking about, because William just stopped and started talking to him. And I didn't think anything of it at the time. And it wasn't until he knocked on my door that I actually met him properly. So he knocked on my door. William was actually in at mine at the time. And when I looked through the spy hole, it wasn't him. It was a child. So I didn't know why a child was knocking on my door. So I just answered it. And when I answered the door, he put his foot through the door, so I couldn't then close it.
The child or Shamil?
No, Shamil. The child disappeared instantly. So
do you think that was like he'd done that to make sure you answered the door?
He
made a child.
Wow. Yeah, okay, yeah. So he
quite intimidating.
Yeah. So he tricked me into answering the door by having a child there, Yeah, that was obvious from the second the foot was in the door and the child was gone. But there wasn't much I could do about it apart from try and push him out.
Yeah.
So I started shouting to William, like, help, he's coming, like someone trying to come in. And William said, is it Shamil? And I said, yes. And he said, let him in. I think he probably said let him in because he's scared of him.
Yeah.
And because he'd instructed me to let him in, psychologically, I just stopped fighting and I let him in because in that split second you really wish that you hadn't done that, but then it just, because you only had a second to think about it, it was just automatic. So kind of maybe I was trusting William. I didn't know what was going to happen. Maybe he knew what was going to happen, but I don't think he knew either. So also, I don't know if I was winning the fight at the,
of course,
the door.
Yeah.
So I could feel as guilty as I like about that split second that I let go of the door, but whether I was winning the fight or not is another question, because there was a foot in the door. I don't know what I would have done. So then he came in, he made some excuse to William, and then William left. And the thing is, William is scared, so he would just do what you told him to. Mm-hmm. And then William didn't come back. And then he was alone with me in the flat. And it's kind of like that moment that the door shut and William had left, and then Shamil was in the flat with me, was like the second that you realise like in how much danger you're actually in. And it was, he was like literally circling me. And I was like I was a bit like a scared rabbit, basically.
So there was no pretense of friendship. It was just an immediate sense of intimidation.
He was, so he was saying things that appeared like friendship, but it was absolutely terrifying. So it was like, I want you to be my girlfriend. This is a stranger that I'd never met before, and he's just come out of prison for something violent. And he was saying things like, I'll buy you a car, I'll buy you a house. And I was thinking, how is a criminal going to buy me a house? Like, I'm just terrified about what's happening right now. And he was trying to hug me, and he was trying to kiss me, and I was trying to push him off me. I was trying not to be aggressive, because I didn't want him to be aggressive back to me. Mm-hmm. I was really terrified. So that's kind of how it started, and then it just progressed from there. He was undressing me, and I couldn't stop him from undressing me. I was trying to say, like, don't do that, and stop, and don't take my underwear off. And I was just trying to plead with him, and, you know, it sounds really pathetic, but I was so scared.
Of course. It doesn't sound pathetic at all. It sounds terrifying.
Yeah, sorry. I managed to, bargain with him somehow to leave my underwear on. I just said, please leave my underwear. Don't take anything else off. Like, just stop now at that. And then he was, because he was trying to pretend to be nice, he was like, okay, I'll leave your underwear on. And then he put me down on the bed and got on top of me. And then he was undressing him. He must have undressed himself first, sorry, but like, he was in his boxers, and I even remember the colour, which I won't share with you. He agreed not to leave my underwear on, so he just moved my underwear out of the way and then started to rape me. And I knew what he was doing, but I just was too terrified to like say anything else. Mm-hmm. And I just had to like wait underneath him until he'd stopped. I'd done like all the pleading that I could possibly do. And then when he started to rape me, I thought, like, I can't actually get out of this anymore. Like, it's happened now. So I've just got to wait till it's over. Sorry.
No, you don't need to apologize. It's an awful situation. And after he'd finished, did he leave the house?
Actually, I think he just wanted to put me, I don't know why he's, so I think he was a bit of a psycho. I can't even say that in a nice way, to be honest. And I don't think I should have to say it in a nice way.
Of course.
I don't know what was going through his head, but he was asking me afterwards, like, if I found him attractive, and he was asking me if what I thought of his body. And I was very aware that I'd just been raped, mm-hmm. and I was also still very terrified of him. So I also wasn't going to give him the satisfaction of like what he wanted to hear. Mm-hmm. So I was like, and I was at the point where I didn't care anymore as well. So like, he just raped me. So I actually hate you. And I now kind of wish I was dead as well. So I don't really care what you do to me if I tell you you're ugly and mm. that I hate you. And so I said those things and he was like, what? But he didn't react. I don't think he knew how to react because I don't think he knew what he was doing. I don't think he was all there psychologically. And then he took me around to William's house, William's flat. And then he was saying in front of William, don't worry, I only got her to give me a blowjob, which isn't even remotely what happened at all. And I don't know why he was saying that to him. And I was just, the entire time I was still shaking and not saying anything because I thought, what am I going to say? I just really wanted to get rid of him. So I thought if I just wait until he's gone, then I can actually process what's just happened. And then he wanted to leave William's flat. So he left and, then he wanted to kiss me and I had to be like, pinned me against the wall and I had to kiss him. And then he left. And then finally I was on my own and I thought, oh God, that was awful. And then William came back round and then William was having a go at me because he was like, how could you give him a blowjob? And I was just, I was just, you know, that didn't even happen. That's not what happened. Just leave me alone. And it's actually really messed up. It's really, really messed up. And it's not like what it might look like in the movies and it's not, it doesn't make any sense. And, you know, one thing would lead to another. And William pretended to leave my flat after we'd gone back round. And then I called my friend on the phone, who's my friend from school. And I told her that I'd just been raped. And this was like the first moment I'd actually got to be myself. She cried, I cried, and she cried on the phone with me. And it was like a really upsetting moment. But then I had to go because William hadn't really left because he'd wanted to actually spy on what I was going to say to my friend. And then he realized that I'd been raped. And then he was like really apologetic for the way he just behaved. And he wanted to help me and he wanted to call his auntie and see, because he wanted an adult woman to talk to me to see what to do next. And they were all talking about going to the police. I was like, oh my God, you know, I couldn't, I hadn't had time yet to like process anything. So I was like still in like this absolute shock and still shaking. Sorry, I'll give space to.
No, please. Would you like to have some water?
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Well, just let us know if you want a longer break. Okay. So, I mean, that's quite a huge change in your experience living in that area. And this individual, Shamil, was clearly very dangerous and disturbed. Was he part of a wider group or was he kind of a lone agent at that point?
He had some family members. He had a brother and he had a cousin, and I was aware of that, but I didn't understand the way gangs work. So I felt like he was a lone agent, but he clearly wasn't. And I think me not realizing that he was part of a wider gang was a dangerous for me, because the risk was a lot higher than I anticipated. So when I finally did speak to the police a few days later, so it wasn't, hadn't left it too long. I just, you know, needed to process, and lots of people were trying, but the people I had told were trying to convince me to speak to the police.
Right. Yeah.
So I went to the police and I spoke to them in absolute confidence, because I never told anybody. I didn't tell William. I didn't tell my friend, my next door neighbor who we were friends with. I didn't tell my family. Because I was really terrified of what Shamil might do or what his family might do to me if they knew that I was speaking to the police about what he'd done. So, going back to the actual risk I was in. So when I'm speaking to the police, I don't realise what's going to happen next. I'm too scared to, I've got this ideal in my head that if he's arrested, they'll have to tell him what he's arrested for. So they'll arrest him and they'll take him to prison and everyone will know what he did. And that it was me that reported it.
Yeah.
And then the other dangerous people on the street, like his brother and his cousin, are going to come round and be like, why have you just reported my brother or cousin to the police? Now look what's happened. So I was terrified. I was really, really scared. And I don't think I got the right advice, but if I'd have realised that the wider gang was... And this was a plot. So it was a plot. They'd set Shamil on me because Shamil is the aggressor, as it were. So I don't know what they call it, the Rottweiler of the group or whatever, you know. So if somebody needs beating up, they'll send him out. If somebody needs to be raped, they'll send him out. So they knew that it would make me more vulnerable to being abused by them as well. So so 2 days later, Ali came round with his friend, and I was raped again by Ali and his friend.
Was this someone you knew already or a stranger?
So I knew of Ali. But again, I'd only been there a month. So I'd,
This is after just...
a month of living in the YMCA, So I'd only been out a month. So I barely knew any of them. And I'd barely had chance to, I'd had a couple of introductions. Ali was one of the guys who had called me on the phone asking for William. Yeah. But I didn't really know them at all. Okay. And I didn't know his friend at all. He was a complete stranger, and this was the first time that, like, obviously, that anything like that had ever happened to me.
But and so you had told the police. So did anything happen from that?
I told the police about Shamil. I told them that I was afraid of him being arrested. Because I was told by my counsellor at college that if I wanted that I should tell the police at least for their information, so that they've got the sort of intelligence on him, and that if I didn't want him to be arrested, then I didn't have to do that. And the reason that I was worried about him being arrested was because of what would the repercussions
of
that?
Yeah.
I wasn't really reassured about it. So there was nothing like, oh, let us help you tell your family and then maybe you can go back home and where you'll be safe, or we could rehouse you somewhere where you could feel safe, because I lived on the same street as Shamil and I lived on the same street as Ali Sultan as well, and his brother and his, you know, and the other people that could potentially be a risk to myself, to my life, to me physically.
But did the police, when you told them, did they give you options or did you give you advice, or was it more like, thank you for the report, that's now I now records?
Well, the advice was, if you want him to be arrested, report it as rape. But if you don't, it was this way around. So if you don't want him to be arrested, you have to say it was consensual.
Right.
But if you say that it's rape, then we have to arrest him.
Right, okay.
So they wrote me a statement to say it was consensual, which seems to be common practice really for the police to actually write your statement for you. Okay. But I was quite surprised by that.
Yeah.
And all I had to do was sign the statement that had been written for me.
Right.
To say that it was consensual. And then it would just go down as intelligence.
Right. Okay. So it sounds like it started to spiral quite quickly from the point of Shamil to Ali and his friend coming round. How quickly then did it spiral further out of control?
I think really it was spiraling from the first rape. So 2 days later, I was raped by Ali and his friend. And then another 2 days after that, I was raped by his brother. A few weeks after that, Ali would keep coming back round. It wasn't every day, but it was roughly twice a week. And sometimes it would be two men in a day. So I'm aware that with other victims, it escalates and it becomes multiple men in a night or in one weekend. This was the very beginning of the grooming for me. So I didn't have that period of time where they were giving me gifts and weaning me into being friends with them. They just went straight in with quite traumatic rape incidents and events for me.
And sorry, this is going to seem like an incredibly insensitive question, but why didn't you leave the area at that point?
I was planning to leave. I was thinking in my head, like, I've got to get out of here, but I didn't actually know how because I was helped into the YMCA in the first place. So I filled in a form and they found me a flat to live in. So I didn't actually know how to move house at that time. Like, I didn't know how to get away. I didn't know how to tell my family because I put a lot of blame on myself. And I think that the way that I would have described it to my family, because of the blame, the self-blame, they would have blamed me as well. So I thought everyone would blame me. I thought it was my fault. I thought I'd got myself into a really bad situation. And I was ashamed. Mm-hmm. So I found it really difficult to actually say, help me. I'm like, I really desperately need help. I didn't know how to help myself. So it took me a couple of months. So not long, but it took me a little while to actually figure out how to move. It couldn't have been an instant thing for me.
During the period this was happening and escalating, were you still attending college?
I was at the end of my A levels. So for the first rape, when I was first raped by Shamil, the one that I just described, it was the weekend before all my major exams. Oh. So I had 6 exams in 5 days that following week, and he'd rape me on the Sunday, and my exam was going to be on the Monday. I think I had a psychology exam on Monday, and then I had an English exam and a psychology exam on the Tuesday. I had a biology exam on the Wednesday, and then I went to the police on the Wednesday, and then, you know, I had some more exams on the Thursday and Friday, and then I spoke to the, and I was raped again on Thursday, and I went back to the police and gave the statement on the Saturday. So after that, because all my exams were over, it was the summer holidays, and I was waiting for my A-level results. Mm-hmm. So I was even raped the day before I got my A-level results, and I, you know, walked up to college in a bit of a daze to like pick them up, and I expected to fail everything, but I didn't, luckily.
Okay, so the experience is horrifying and probably at that age, and probably hard to process in terms of like, what do you do when this has started happening? But what with a grooming gang, what is the purpose for them to begin to do this to you? As in, are they trying to make you somebody that's like a slave to them? Or are they trying to, you know, is it simply sexual abuse? Why, when you said that they had Shamil as the kind of attack dog that would go out and do this, why would they do this to people?
So I don't know if they are fully aware of what they're trying to do themselves. Maybe that's me not giving them the amount of intelligence they deserve, or whether it's, you know, I get the feeling that it's a learnt behavior from them. Mm-hmm. So they just know, they know how to do it because they've been sexually abused themselves. Mm-hmm. is how I feel. But with the Telford Grooming Gang, they were also the people who raped me were also already forcibly pimping out other underage girls as well. So they were doing that for money, and they were they had been grooming them probably, and well, I know, in a very similar way to the way they groomed me, to accept this lifestyle, and then so they could continue to abuse you. And I think that these traumatic, really traumatic events that they inflict on you, is a way of breaking a human being, the same way that you break a horse. So I kind of felt that way. I would, like, when I was like in the pits of my depression about it, I would feel that I'd been broken, like you break a horse when, I don't know if you know how they break horses, but they, so I'm talking about like a wild horse, and taming a wild horse. So you, tie it to, I don't know everything about
horses, fine, go ahead,
but like, yeah. So I think you tie it to a post, and then you sort of chase it. This is the simplistic version. You chase it round in a circle until eventually it's physically exhausted, and then it gives up, and then you can tame it from then, and you can teach it. You can teach it the tricks, and
its will's been broken, essentially.
Yeah. So I feel like that's what they did to me. They broke my will to, well, broke my will to live, and then, or the will to defend myself, and then I gave up, and I gave up on myself. And I think there's even a very, I think I feel like I can even pinpoint the moment it happened, and the moment I felt like this was my life now, and I'm a slut, and I can't actually change that, and there's nothing else I can do, and that's it from now on. And that's kind of how they bring you into it. Sorry, I feel like I went off on a tangent.
No, it makes complete sense, and it's a really clear description for, like, because for me, it's just so hard to, the two things that are so hard to process is the pain of what you were put through, and the cruelty that these people inflicted on other humans, and the explanation on both sides there about the fact that it was a learnt behaviour, and the breaking of the horse, which is a very good analogy, make it very understandable. So I know we've met before, and I remember you talked about a party incident, and I was wondering if you'd tell us about that.
So I was taken to a party by a guy that I'd essentially met very recently. Well, that day, actually. But I'd been raped. I was actually 4 months into being raped twice a week or three times a week. So I was quite psychologically damaged at that point, and going through quite a lot, and not sure where my head was at, and a very vulnerable state in my ordeal, really. But he took me to a party, first of all, he took me he wanted to get me drunk, but I didn't actually drink. So he'd taken me to a Tesco to like pick up some alcohol. And
sorry, was this a member of the gang or was this someone you'd met separately?
It all looks separate.
Sure. So you felt like
he was a member of the gang.
Got you. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I felt like I'd met him separately, but actually I met him on the same street. So why would I even think that? But so he took me to Tesco and I sat in the car and waited for him to come out, and he picked up some Smirnoff vodka, which it is a tactic that they use for their victims, and it probably worked on other victims, but I hated alcohol and I specifically hated vodka. So I was just rolling my eyes and thinking, oh God, he's bought vodka. But I didn't say anything. And then he drove me all round. He took me onto a dual carriageway, and then drove a really long way basically to somewhere, an area that I actually knew, which was not that far away from my house.
Okay.
It was actually next to the Morrisons, which was my local shopping centre that I walked to, supermarket that I walked to. And I thought, why is he taking me all this way around? And it didn't make sense to me at the time, but afterwards, in hindsight, it does, because you can always look in hindsight and see all the problems all the warning signs. But at the time, I was just confused. I was like no idea why he did that when the place is right here. But he was actually trying to confuse me.
To make it seem like you were going far away.
Yeah, he was trying to make me feel lost.
Right.
And he was trying to make me feel helpless, like I wouldn't be able to walk home, I could walk home. Yeah.
And you were drinking, presumably, at this point. Were you drinking the vodka?
Oh, God, no. Right. No, I'll tell you.
Okay.
So he poured me a drink at the party. So we got to the party. There were lots of different people there. They were all a mix of different people. But it was mostly men. There were two other women there who were older than me, and they were already very, very drunk. So I never really got to know those two other ladies that were there. And he poured me a drink, it was like a normal sort of tumbler glass, but it was a tall one. And he poured half vodka and half lemonade in it. And I watched him pour it, and I thought, there's absolutely no way that I'm going to be able to drink that. Because I hated the taste. It made, I couldn't even imagine drinking it. But I was embarrassed by that because I was a teenager and it was cool to drink. So I didn't let them know that I wasn't going to drink it. Mm. I just sort of styled it a bit, and I was like, you know how you always find him in the party, in the kitchen at parties. Mm. So I was like hanging out in the kitchen with the drink in my hand next to the sink and pretending to take a sip and then pouring it when no one was looking, pouring it into the sink. But that was me being like very embarrassed about not being able to actually drink. So I think in a way I don't think it helped. I don't think it actually made any difference. I think the only difference it made is that I remembered what happened more vividly, and it was a lot more painful. So I don't feel like it. Not drinking didn't really help me in either way. It might have helped if they'd have known that I wasn't drinking, because if they'd have known that I was like fully compos mentis, then maybe they would have changed their mind about what they were going to try and make me do. Maybe they would have had more respect for me, because they used the girl being drunk as an excuse to say that that's enough reason they shouldn't be drunk, and that's why they deserve to be raped. So maybe if they knew, but it might not. I don't think it would have made any difference. But yeah, so they tried to get me drunk. they thought, so that's another warning sign, really, but I didn't recognise it. I thought it was cool to drink, and that's why they were trying to get me drunk.
And was he being fairly friendly at this point?
Yeah, yeah. He
was not aggressive?
No. He was lovely, and, you know, he was being nice, and his friends were lovely as well, and they were all, like, being welcoming, and there was music on, and it was like a normal house party. And then he sort of convinced me into the bedroom a bit later on. I don't know, maybe I haven't got enough excuse. Maybe I haven't, you know, I was vulnerable, and I was already being raped on a regular basis. And part of me was trying to take back control all the time. So I was very confused about whether I should consent to sex or whether I shouldn't, and what the difference was anymore, because I put a lot of blame on myself for times that I'd actually been raped, which I thought were consensual because they really pushed me into it, or I'd given up at some point and I'd allowed it to happen to myself. And that's how I'd felt about all these scenarios. So I was trying to, very sort of naively trying to be like, I'd like to have sex when I want to have sex. So if I go out and find it, then, you know, maybe that's, will make me feel better about sex as a whole. I think they count on that. I think this is another way that they're actually grooming you into being very confused about consent. So he tricked me into the bedroom. I went into the bedroom with him. He obviously knew what he was going to do, and he'd lied to me the entire time. And then he raped me anally. It's really difficult to talk about. And I think one reason I talk about it is because it is so humiliating, that humiliating feeling used to be a feeling that would induce suicidal thoughts in myself.
Okay.
And now I share that because that humiliation stops you from seeking help.
Okay.
And now I don't care, because I think if I put myself through admitting what happened, then that humiliation can no longer rule me anymore.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons that I talk about this particular rape, because I think it is really humiliating. And I think that it's one thing that happens to some rape victims, and they don't want to come forward because they blame themselves for, like, literally putting themselves in the bedroom alone with them in that vulnerable situation. And then this is what happens, and that therefore it's their fault, which is wrong. And I'll just describe it though.
You don't have to.
I won't describe. I'm going to describe why it's a crime.
Okay.
In the Sexual Offences Act, you can consent to some things and not consent to other things.
Okay.
And if you make your consent clear, then, or your non-consent clear, the perpetrator knows that you are not consenting, then that's rape. And you can also, in the Sexual Offences Act, consent to something and then withdraw your consent at any time.
Okay.
And then it's rape. Then it becomes rape. So you can consent to a sexual act at the beginning, but if you try and you signal that you want to stop and they don't stop, then they know that you're not consenting anymore, and that becomes rape. So it's not really up for debate for the individual people who are thinking whether you deserve it or you don't deserve it. In the eyes of the law, that was non-consensual sex, which is rape.
Yeah.
So I was raped anally by him. I tried to escape. I screamed. I shouted. I said, stop. One reason was because at the beginning I thought it was an accident, so I didn't actually expect him to continue to try and have sex with me after I was saying that it was, that you know, that I was in pain. He knew what I was going to do, and he knew that I was going to try and pull away, which now I can look in hindsight and say he had experience. Mm-hmm. So he knew that it was going to be painful, and he knew what a victim does when that pain hits you, which is to pull away. And he knew I was going to pull away, and he was already prepared for that. So he pushed his body into mine, knowing that if he did that, I couldn't escape. Mm-hmm. And I smacked my head on the headboard. I was trapped, and he knew that I was trapped there. And he then I just had to wait until he was finished. And, you know, that's horrible. And that is intentional rape. Mm. That is intentional rape from someone who is an experienced serial rapist. And that's the reason that I share that incident even to this day. And unfortunately, I did report that to the police, but they couldn't find enough evidence that we even knew each other. He said that he'd never met me before, and they couldn't put, because no one at the party would come forward either, they couldn't put me and him in the same room together ever. So I couldn't even prove that I knew him, or, you know, I don't know why, because I ID'd him in an ID parade.
Wow. But,
yeah.
And it's still...
Yeah. Yeah. So I am... what do you call it when you sort of positively ID'd him in an ID parade? But that still wasn't enough evidence to take it forward. Or that's what the police said to me. Sometimes they don't tell you the truth.
Yeah.
Which is the... Yeah.
You come across as very strong, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
When you're telling the story, you come across as a very strong person.
Oh, thank you. Mm.
Hi there, this is Ben Powell Jones. We're just going to take a quick break from today's episode to talk a little bit about our sponsor. A brand new six-part podcast from Message Heard and Podimo, Who Robs a Banksy, follows journalist Jake Warren as he sets out to explore the stranger-than-fiction tale of the man who kidnapped a Banksy statue from the middle of central London in broad daylight and held it to ransom. The act would lead to an almost 20-year war of bad blood, relations, and legal battles that are still being waged today, and it all comes down to one man and one vendetta. But it doesn't end there. The story will take us on a journey through the UK's most subversive subcultures, from art heists and art terrorists to 80s football hooliganism and the 90s illegal rave scene. And throughout it all, Jake will be trying to get hold of the most elusive and famed anonymous artist in the world. In this new six-part series, host Jake Warren speaks to the Tiger King of the art scene, Andy Link, and those closest to Banksy himself, exposing their two-decade-long feud and attempting to track down the world's most elusive anonymous artist. Who Robs a Banksy is available from the 3rd of May, wherever you get your podcasts. To hear the whole series early and ad-free, subscribe to Podimo UK on Apple Podcasts. Now back to the episode.
Sorry, you were asking me about the party.
No, that's fine. I guess in trying to understand the things that these people do and the sort of like depths that they'll go to, why do you think that he bothered pretending to be nice and pretending to be different from the gang?
They want you to consent for as long as possible. I think it's not in, first of all, they enjoy the chase, as it were. They enjoy the pretense. So they, use it as a reason to disrespect you. They use it as a way of laughing at you behind your back.
Right.
They use it as, look at this silly girl, she deserves it. So they're looking for reasons all the time why you deserve to be abused. And if you're consenting for the longest and complying for the longest period of time, they have less work to do to get what they want out of you. It makes it easier for them to abuse you at the last minute.
Do you think, I mean, it's probably conjecture, but do you think they view women as lesser beings, like lower life forms? I mean, the thought of putting people through these things, do you think they were treating men in the same way, maybe not with sexual abuse, but in other ways? Or do you think it's specifically women?
So I think, you know, misogyny was involved. I think there is a hatred there for women. But I also think there's an element of, it's called dissocial personality disorder. But it, it used to be called psychopathic personality disorder, where they really cannot identify with the feelings and of other individuals, and actually sort of aiming to please themselves all the time, and they can't identify with other people's pain.
It's like a complete lack of empathy.
Yes, complete lack of empathy, yeah. And I believe that, you know, there's several things at play there for the reason why they can actually do this to women or anyone.
Okay. Well, that, I mean, awful story and an awful experience. But I'm aware that at some point you started to try to plan an escape, didn't you, to go to university? So how did that come about?
So I got my A-level results after being raped the night before. Very surprised by them because I thought I would fail them all. And, you know, I did get a D in psychology because I literally was in one of the exams I'd written a suicide note rather than actually do the exam.
And did you give that in?
Yeah. I mean, it was a bit cryptic. So it wasn't, it wasn't obvious that I was, you know, I wasn't saying I'm going to kill myself now, because maybe they would have flagged that up and done something.
You'd hope so.
Yeah. It was more like it was actually more like a sorry to have let you down. And oh, it's really upsetting to remember now, but sorry to have like wasted your time, because you're going to open this exam paper and it's completely blank. So that it was along those lines. So I'd sort of written a cryptic suicide note, but it probably just looked like an apology, basically. Mm-hmm. So I knew that I'd failed that exam. Hang on a minute, where am I?
And then, but you had got enough grades.
Yeah, I got a C in English and I was like, yes. I wouldn't even expect that, but I was like, oh, something over a C, you know, is much better than I was expecting anyway. Because before that, I had some little plans in my head and I was thinking, let me go back to college and retake my last year, and then at least most of the time I'll be out. Like, if I can continue being a full-time student, I'll be out of my flat most of the time, so they won't be able to find me at home as they were doing during the summer holidays. My next plan was maybe I can get a job and I'll be out most of the time. I'd got a part-time job, but I mean, you know, a better job that had more hours. But then when I got my A-level results, I'd gone back to college to try and go back, and they'd said, well, you've got decent A-level results.
Oh, no.
So we're not going to fund you for another year.
Right.
And they were a bit like matter of fact with me. And I was like, oh, no. And then I was like, oh no, that plan's not going to work. And they said, we'll put you with the student advisor so that you can find out what university you can go to. And when I met the student advisor, oh, she was lovely. A really, really nice lady. I was actually I'd had a fight with William at the time and I was all bruised up.
A physical fight?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
A physical fight, which I don't feel too bad about, because I don't feel like I was beaten up. I feel like it was a fair fight. I hit him first. And then, you know, it was all going on anyway. But she felt bad for me because I was bruised up. So I'd clearly been in some sort of physical altercation. I was a young girl and she was like, you should look after yourself better. She said, do you want to go to university this year or next year? At that point, it was September. So I had to double take for a minute and I said, this year? Like, how much? There was only 4 months of the year left. I was like, what do you mean this year? And she was like, yeah, you can apply through something called clearing, which is where there's some spaces left at university on the courses. So they're trying to get rid of them as quickly as possible so you can apply. I wanted to do psychology, but that's why I was doing A-level psychology. But all the places were sort of taken up for psychology, and I didn't want to wait a year.
No.
And I didn't want to go to a university that was nearby either. Yeah, so I didn't want to go to Wolverhampton University, and I didn't want to go to Birmingham University. Nothing against those universities. It's
too close.
Too local. Yeah, too close. And I thought they can come and get me if I go to either of those locations. So we looked at mental health nursing, and there were lots of places, and I think we might have picked the first university on the list, one of the first universities on the list, which was Anglia Ruskin, A in alphabetical order.
Sure.
She really bent over backwards to get me in to the university. Yeah,
she'd seen something there.
Yeah.
And at this point, how long had it gone on for with the Telford gang?
So it had been going on for 4 months, 5 months.
You did manage to escape, so to speak, to university, and you got a place in university and you moved there, which you hoped would be the end of the situation. But unfortunately, it wasn't, was it?
No. So to begin with, I was very glad that I'd escaped. So I was like, you can't imagine the relief, and I really liked the town. I suddenly had this appreciation for life. Like, so I loved the town. I loved the bricks in the street.
And where was this, sorry, again?
It was in Chelmsford. Essex, okay. Yeah. And it's some of the buildings are like fairly new, or they were anyway at the time. And so maybe the floor had been recently changed in the high street or something. And I was just in love with everything. I just thought, oh my God, this is great. I even at university, they had these automatic hand sanitize the gel in the toilets would come out, and it smelt like it was a cherry flavor, and I'd even remember the smell of that, and thought it was great because it reminded me of like when we were kids and we had some shampoo that was cherry flavored smelt what's this
scented
yeah, yeah. So I was really glad. I was like, I felt lucky to be alive. I thought, oh my God, I've like actually made it. I've got it out of there. Very quickly though, I started to develop symptoms of PTSD, but I didn't realize what that was at the beginning. So it started off with, flashbacks, but I wasn't conscious of the flashbacks, so I didn't know that I was having memories. I sort of, the first I would know about it was that I'd be fine sort of trying to do some work on the computer in my room, in halls at university. And then the next thing I know, I would be sitting underneath my desk crying, and then I would be like, why am I crying? So I wouldn't even feel the emotion of crying. So I wouldn't even like, so it would be, it was
so
very
almost
strange.
Like lost space. Like you just have these blackout periods.
Like a blackout period. Yeah. So this was happening sort of probably about twice a week. Sort of a few weeks into it, I caught myself shouting at Ali. So shouting at Ali Sultan, who was one of the men who'd abused me. But there was no one there. Obviously, this was a past event, and I was repeating the same words that I'd said to him at the time. And it just suddenly made me aware that I was having a memory.
And this wasn't like a nightmare. This was like awake.
Awake, yeah.
Awake. Just suddenly having a vivid flashback.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. So I realised what I was remembering, so I realised the incident that I was remembering, and I didn't even realise that was an issue. So I didn't realise I'd been traumatised by that situation, because I'd been so groomed into believing that everything I was doing was consensual, that incident that had happened was just like another day while I was living there. But all of a sudden I was having these memories about it, and I thought it was bizarre. So I was shouting at Ali, and I thought, why am I shouting at Ali? Why am I having this memory? Why am I even bothered about it? Why am I crying? And you know, it was a bit of a a shocking moment for me. You know, it stays with me now. So I just, you know, really had no idea what was going on. And I think, you know, that's when I started realizing that I was more bothered by what had happened than I realized, mm-hmm. That I'd first realized. And I called them episodes because I didn't know how to explain what they were. Mm. And it was happening so early on when I started uni that even though I was doing mental health nursing, we hadn't got to that bit yet. Mm. So we were actually doing a foundation course in the first year, which had all the different nursing aspects of it. So we weren't doing mental health nursing. Mm-hmm. We were doing like general adult nursing. And so we hadn't got to that bit. So I didn't know what the hell was going on. And I didn't recognize them as a panic attack because maybe it wasn't a panic attack. But I didn't feel in panic. I felt upset and I felt distressed, but I didn't even know if I knew what to call it, distress.
So you basically, it sounds as though you didn't have the tools to identify what was happening.
Yeah.
To identify kind of trauma or post traumatic stress and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. So certain things would trigger me off as well, and I couldn't identify triggers. Mm. But one trigger was like when because you just have to live it, because you're living it every day when you're being raped every day, but you still have to get up and carry on and feed yourself. And, you know, every time I opened the fridge or every time I cooked pasta on the hob when I was eating, I would maybe have a memory of the time that I was eating pasta in the YMCA, but I knew I was or I had just got raped afterwards, or after I'd been raped, I had something to eat. So I'd always have this feeling that it was still going on. Mm. And then I would end up in my room again on the floor, crying my eyes out because I tried to make pasta. I thought it was really weird and I didn't know how to explain it to anyone.
And were you at that point in time, were you building relationships and friendships in university, or were you kind of just keeping yourself away, keeping your head down?
So I was trying at uni, but I felt really, I couldn't help it. I felt really different to everyone.
Yeah, of course.
I felt like other people are... other people my own age are just come from their parents' house and they are like free and innocent and they want to go out and party. And I was probably a bit terrified of partying because of the party incident. And I was probably a bit more terrified of drinking as well because of the incident. And so I wasn't interested in any of the things they were doing and I just felt very different to them. And I felt like if they knew what had happened or who I was, because I was this really bad person that had been behaving very like sexually bad, then they wouldn't like me. So I thought I was a bad person and that I was keeping this really bad, horrible secret about who I was. I felt like I'd got a second chance to start again and not let people have that reputation about me. But I was keeping that, I had to keep that a secret from people. So I found it really difficult to make friends for that reason.
Yeah, it makes complete sense. And what was the point that... Because eventually what happened was you got connected to a different gang, didn't you?
Yeah. So while I was still in the YMCA in Telford, it was Shamil. Shamil had been in prison with... he introduced me to his cousin who was still in prison. Mm. His cousin who was in prison... was coming out on day release because he was in a Cat D prison where they allow them to come out. Mm-hmm. He was friends with or connected with someone else in prison who was part of another gang. And he I don't know, sold my number or sold my details or gave them, traded my details for something else in prison, and sort of set up a meeting with me and another man from Birmingham. And that's how I ended up with the Birmingham, introduced to the Birmingham gang. When I met that man, he was a lot nicer to me than the Telford gang. He would tell me that they were wrong for the way they were treating me. I would confide in him. So I found friendship in him. And I found that I felt like I could be myself with them because I could be honest about my life in the YMCA with them. Mm. And they wouldn't find it weird. They understood because they were living the life as well. Obviously not under the same circumstances as myself, but from being in that circle, as it were. So I was introduced to him, and then I was introduced to other members of his gang, other members of his family, and they were nice to me and they were okay with me. And I found it easier to hang out with them because they weren't as hateful and sort of intentionally abusive as the gang in Telford. So the gang in Telford were really evil to me. They were like, they intended to inflict harm on me. They were laughing at me, embarrassing me, humiliating me, making me feel intentionally worthless. And then I had this gang in Birmingham who were being nice to me and welcoming and sort of not being forceful or pushy.
Yeah.
But still expecting from me what the other gang had. But because I was more experienced now, with the extreme experience that I'd had from the Telford gang, I knew how they wanted me to behave, and how to behave in a way that would make them have more respect for me. It's complicated to explain, but this is the effects of the manipulation, what actually happened through the trauma that they put me through, was intentional to get me to start behaving in a way that they was socially acceptable in their circle.
Yeah,
if that makes sense. And then that made me feel comfortable in their circle and segregated me from everyone else.
And were you still, when you, with the Birmingham gang, were you at university at this point when you'd started to, were you still in contact with them, or did you move up to Birmingham?
Yeah. So to begin with, no, I was still in Telford.
Yeah.
And then I moved to Essex. This was my chance to escape.
Yeah.
And then I started having really terrible mental health in Essex.
Yes.
I couldn't get on with the people in Essex. I felt different from everyone.
Yeah.
It wasn't anything to do with them or their fault. But I just had this terrible feeling in myself. And I still, the Birmingham gang were calling me to them, and I felt more comfortable with them. And I felt like I could be myself with them because I felt like that was my honest, true self, was that I was worthless.
Yeah.
And that I, and if other people, I was trying to keep up this pretense in Essex that I was somebody, and I found that really difficult, and I found that really like a responsibility on my shoulders.
Because
really
the Birmingham gang knew your secret, so you didn't need to hide it from them because they were part of that lifestyle.
Yes, yeah.
And did they maintain the same level of kindness that you've described, if we can, I mean, kindness is the wrong word, but you understand what I mean, in that they weren't like the Telford gang, or was there a changing point?
So some of them remained kind and some of them turned nasty. But then I would have the ones that were nasty. So I'd have like a really bad experience with them. I might actually get raped by them. And then I would turn back to my friends that were nice to me. Mm. And I would stick with them, even though they had introduced me to the nasty one, if that makes sense. But they would say things, manipulative things like, I'm sorry that my cousin treated you that way. I'm sorry that that happened. I didn't know he was going to do that, but please don't judge me by his behavior, because it wasn't me, it was him.
Mm.
So they would make me feel that I had to be loyal to them, because they were loyal to me, because they hadn't been the ones that hurt me. It was someone else.
So although it's a different gang, and had you moved to Birmingham at this point? Is that
no?
Coming back and forth to study.
Yeah.
So even though it was a different gang, ultimately it was still the same manipulation to get the same end game and
product. Yeah.
How long were you then involved with the Birmingham gang for?
So I was involved in the Birmingham gang for on and off for about 5 years.
Wow. Okay.
For the first year, so I was abused in Telford in 2007. And then for the first year after that, the whole of 2008, I was deeply involved with them.
Yeah.
And then after 2008, my mental health was really deteriorating. Mm. I was really suicidal. I really strongly hated myself. And I wanted to try and do something about it. I was also learning at university techniques to help mental health.
Yeah.
I was becoming wiser as to sort of having ideas of how to get out of the gang, and that I wanted to be out of the gang, and that I wanted to do something that didn't make me feel as bad.
And when you say you knew you wanted to be out of the gang, you know, I know it's a very, very complex topic, but I know some people would look and say, well, why didn't you just leave?
Mm.
What stops you just leaving when you're somebody that's being victimized by a gang like that?
So it's something that I would have thought myself as well. Like sometimes I was in surrounded by them in a room and thinking to myself, what am I doing here? Why don't I just leave? And it was another reason that I really hated myself, because I couldn't understand it. It was another form of PTSD. It was another symptom of PTSD, but I was physically reliving the events or reliving what had happened to me, through my actions. And that was making me feel more comfortable than when I was in Essex having terrible flashbacks and feeling very distressed about it. So it's hard to just explain psychologically how it works.
Yeah.
But I would have, if I didn't, when I tried to stay away from the gang, I would start having nightmares. I would start having the flashbacks again. I'd have really distressing episodes where I could barely breathe. I was so upset. And when I was in the gang in Birmingham, that didn't happen anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But it still happened, because there were some incidents that were so dangerous. I was putting myself in such dangerous situations that I thought one day I could get killed. And what would happen then? Because they wouldn't, like, this is upsetting to think about, but like, these friends of mine, they would probably panic or freak out if they killed me by accident or if they killed me on purpose. What are they going to do with my body? They're not going to call the ambulance. They're not going to call the police and say, we've got this dead girl here. They're going to dump me somewhere.
Yeah.
And then my parents are going to find me dumped somewhere. Not my parents finding me, but like, find out that there's been a body found and it's me. And then my parents will never understand or never know what happened to me. So that was a really upsetting thought. And that was the biggest drive that made me want to get out of the gang, because I did not want for my parents to go through that. And I felt really distressed about the way my life was going as well. And I didn't want, this wasn't what I had planned.
Yes.
as a teenager, or, you know, when you think about your future, this is not what I had planned. And every day I could just see myself potentially becoming a sex worker and that being my life. And that's not what I don't mean one of the sex workers that make loads of money. I mean, like, I don't know, on the street doing drugs. And it's not what I wanted for my life. So it really encouraged me to stay at university. And at one time I saw it very, very black and white, that I was either at university going to become a nurse or I was going to be a prostitute. And I only had those options available to me.
Wow. I mean, that's quite... When you say there's two options, I mean, they're just such worlds apart. It's like you were living this incredible double life where the other people at your university that were the same age as you probably had no idea that that was a strong potential outcome for you.
Yeah, yeah.
And what? So what... It sounds like, for a lot of people, very understandably, remaining in that space becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy where you get more and more brainwashed and indoctrinated into that lifestyle. So how did you finally decide to move out of that area? And I don't know what to call it, but you know, you some of these people have been brought to justice, haven't they?
Yes.
So how did that all come about?
Okay. So after the year of 2008, when I was not having, you know, I was doing really bad. And then I started to try and get away from the gang. I was managing to go quite a few months. It was like an addiction. So it was like I was going cold turkey, and like I would manage to go a few months cold turkey without going back. There was drugs involved as well. So perhaps it was drugs pulling me back. Mm-hmm. But I didn't accept that at the time. I reported it in 2010, what had happened to me in Telford, because I was a third year nursing student by then. And I had learnt a lot about risks and what risks individual people present and what is a risk, and you know, so somebody who has committed a sexual offence is at risk of doing it again. Mm-hmm. So there's people that I knew that had commit sexual offences against me, so I have the most proof because it happened against me. And they're at risk of doing it again, and some of them I thought or had the feeling that they'd done it before. So I already knew that they probably got other victims. So I started to feel like a responsibility on myself as in becoming a nurse, that I had a responsibility to the public to at least report it. So then I thought, if I report it to the police, even if it doesn't go anywhere, at least I can have that burden relieved off myself. So I went back to the police, I reported it. I went to the Essex police. Essex police obviously didn't really know anything about Telford. So they took down my details, and they took down the details of the people I was reporting. And they said, oh, we'll get back to you, but don't hold up any hopes because this is historic. It had been 3 years by then. The Telford police got in touch with me quite quickly, and they were actually in the middle of an investigation for the men that I had reported.
Right.
So Ali Sultan had already been reported, it was already under investigation.
For similar crimes.
Yes. Yeah. For similar crimes. Operation Chalice had just started taking effect. So came down as quickly as they could, basically, to come and interview me. It was probably a response that I wasn't expecting, but they probably weren't expecting me to come forward either. They were asking me if I knew, and they were asking for other people to come forward. So they thought that that's why I responded, but actually it was complete coincidence.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So I had no idea. And I think my PTSD was untreated at the time. And I was feeling better because I probably because I wasn't doing drugs anymore. And I was also staying away from that lifestyle at the time. I had no idea how unwell I'd been with PTSD. So I didn't realise that I was such a risk of re-traumatisation. And that's what happened when I reported it to the police. They told me about this new this investigation that was already ongoing. Then I realised that it was happening to other girls, and girls a lot younger than me. And for me, that was absolutely devastating. Like, I can't actually explain how bad that actually feels, because not only do we, is it an absolute shock to everyone in the country, I knew what they'd done to me. So the thought of them doing it to other children, other girls, and girls a lot younger than myself, was absolutely heartbreaking. I was really hoping that it was just me. And I thought it was me. I thought it was my fault. I thought I'd done things. I did not realise that that children were being treated in the same way by the same men. And I found that really difficult to cope with at the time. Things, my mental health really spiralled. I ended up attempting suicide. And it was a, it was my first, I'd been feeling suicidal for about 3 years, and it was my first big, and really my only big suicide attempt. And at the time I was, so I think that I was suffering some sort of, some psychotic symptoms, some mild psychotic symptoms, because I believed that Shamil was, had a demon inside him, and that when he raped me, he had put a demon inside me. And when, and that demon would make me behave in ways that I would not want to behave in. So I, in inhumane ways that would actually hurt me. I think, you know, part of it was actually, you know, my PTSD, and this was my way of explaining it. But the, at the time that I attempted suicide, I thought I was, had this urge to go back to the gang, which I think was a symptom of like reliving it. But I thought it was a demon making me, trying to make me go back. And I really did not want to be abused again. And I really did not want that life. And I thought the only way to stop myself was to kill myself. So it, I had a massive, I took a massive overdose of 58 tablets of codeidramol, which made me very sick. I called a friend because I had this one, I lay down to like go to sleep, and I just thought, what a sad way to end it. And then I thought, maybe I'd, maybe that me saying what a sad way to end it means that I don't really want to die. And then I thought, okay, I better call my friend. So I called my friend, and she called an ambulance for me, and I went to A&E. And I was very, very sick. I was very unwell. I was, I couldn't stop being sick. It was very traumatic. And I thought afterwards, what did I have to be afraid of if I'm afraid of this gang? I have just realised that I've just proven to myself that I am the most dangerous person to me. I am the one who's just made a, an attempt on my life. So am I my own attempted murderer, if that makes sense? Like, no one else has necessarily attempted to murder me, but I have tried to murder myself. So I'm actually, who else have I got to be afraid of? So it, in one way, it spurred me on to continue to go ahead with the court case and the investigation. And in another way, it was bad for me because I realised the being abused is probably better than being dead. So I just went back to the gang. I just did what I was thinking, and I just went back. And I don't know if I might have still been a little bit like mentally unwell. I think definitely I was, because I started to come to like a couple of months later and realize, what have I just been doing for the last few months? Like, there were probably loads of other, loads of things happened. I wrote about some of that in my book. I'm very, very lucky that to be alive after that.
At the point that you finally left the Birmingham gang, how many people do you think you've been abused by?
The number 70 was coined a long time ago in 2013 when I was sort of recruited into speak in a documentary for the Hunt for Britain sex gangs. And I had created this map, which is one of the things that I'd done to try and visualize it to myself. And actually, when I'd written it down, it was kind of looked like a map of a gang, which I didn't expect it to. It was like a drug gang, you know, where everybody's connected to everyone else. In total, there were 70 people on it. And I'd kind of marked an X on all the ones that I thought were rape and all the ones that I thought were, I was very scared. And I changed the colours to say, this is a situation that I was terrified in. This is a situation where I was violently raped in. And, you know, there were 70 on there. And the reporter from my explanation of it was saying, you're describing these situations that seem consensual, that you describe as consensual, but actually they pushed you and coerced you into this. So you're describing a gang rape. And that was quite heavy for me. But that's how the number 70 sort of came about. But some of it was, because I was over 18, by law, it would be very complicated to differentiate the times that I was very vulnerable and a vulnerable adult and therefore could not consent, and the times where I did consent, and the times where it was definitely rape. And it would be, so I didn't report anyone from the Birmingham gang. It would be dangerous too for me because there's so many of them that if I reported any of them, all of them would be against me. And then I'd be at risk if I walked down Birmingham. I'm probably at risk anyway, but I kind of have to ignore that and live my life. So I do. So I won't show fear, because so far I've had a track record that nobody's come and made a threat against me. So I'm not going to worry about it. Even if other people are worried for me, and maybe I should be worried, I'm not going to worry because I can't live my life like that. But yeah, that's one reason I haven't reported it. Another reason is because they might not be convicted anyway. There's not much evidence. It's very difficult to find enough evidence for those individual incidents where maybe I consented to sleep with this man, and then the man who had sex with me afterwards, I didn't want to sleep with him, so that was rape. But how are we going to prove that if I just had consented sex with someone else? So it's too complicated, I think, to try and...
That makes a lot of sense. But of the ones that you did report in the in the Telford gang, how many were imprisoned and what were their sentences?
So I actually reported eight or nine people. Only three of them went to court. And two of them were found guilty, and one of them was found not guilty. So Shamil and Ali were found guilty. Shamil got sentenced to 11 years in prison, and Ali got sentenced to 6 years in prison and I think 11 years on license. I think I might be wrong, I've forgotten now, because Ali then was reported again by someone else, and he's still in prison at the moment, even though he served his sentence for me. But because he was reported again, he's still in prison for another sentence, basically, because he abused so many women. And the ones that have reported him are just the are nothing in comparison to the amount of people he actually abused.
It's quite shocking to hear the story, and you know when you get to the bit in the story and you say you thought it was just you, because for someone like me who's never been around anything like that, you just don't imagine it's happening. Do you think it's still happening, and do you think it's happening more than is reported on? You know, what's your view on that?
Yes.
Gangs.
Yeah. So it's still happening. It's definitely still happening. I think they've just found ways to hide it, or ways of threatening their victims in a different way. Like if you report, like they might say things like, if you report me, it's gonna blow up, and it's gonna like in the media, and it's going to be all over. So there's more pressure if you decide to report it than there was before. I mean, there was no pressure before because you'd be ignored anyway. So it was probably like, you might as well report me because they're not going to do anything. In fact, some victims reported it and then were sentenced, were charged themselves with something and have convictions because of things they did while they were being abused. So, or as a result of being abused, or a result of like getting upset and smashing something because they were abused. And then which is horrendous to think about, that the victims are so heavily blamed by society, as well as the men who are abusing them, that we will then actually charge them and convict them for something.
And when you look back over all of your experiences, you know, what's something you've learned from it? When you look back over everything that happened and you've come out of it as a stronger person who now is, you know, you described yourself earlier as a campaigner, would that be the right word?
I don't really know what I would describe myself as, but I, because I always have these ideas that I would like to do something in the media to help people. And then I don't do it because I'm actually very shy, and I'm trying to fight that confidence still. But I really, really want to help people. I want to use my skills in mental health nursing and the people who I meet who become my patients. I want to help them, and I want to at least them to know that because I've been through complex trauma, that when they've been through complex trauma, I can use what I know to help them. And I can use the skills that I've learned in my life, as well as the skills that I've learned through training, and actually make that a comprehensive sort of way of being able to support those people, and the people that I meet through my work. I try to do things. I'm trying to do more. I think I will in the future, because I feel like I'm still young. And I've even had a way to go with my own mental health before I've been at a stage where I can properly help people the way I want to, and the way I envision. But I want to help other victims. I want to help other survivors. I want to help those girls that no one listens to. And I want to help the girls that are judged by everyone, and then not helped because they're judged, and not helped because their behavior has become so complicated and so difficult that other people turn them away, when really I know where that comes from, because even I've struggled with my own behavior, and I've had to learn interpersonal skills and myself to actually overcome that. And I want to be able to pass that on and show other victims and other survivors that actually you can achieve what I have and actually get to a place in your mind and in your life where you're not suffering anymore from your own mental health and from suicidal thoughts and from that worthlessness. I used to think that I was worthless, and I used to believe that everybody else was better than me and that I would never amount to anything. And then by, I don't know, not by luck, by, I think by never giving up, I have actually come out of the other side of it, and I've managed to persevere, and I didn't die when I took that overdose, and I actually made it through the storm just by getting up every day and living and carrying on, and then time sort of did the rest. So I want other people to believe that they can be something and that they can actually overcome what the evil people who have abused them wanted them to believe about themselves, because it is possible. And I don't think that I'm a special case, that I'm the only one who can survive, or I'm the only one that can have this, like, overcome my mental health issues. And, you know, I want everyone to be able to do what I've done, basically. So that's why I try and pass it on to other people and pass it on to my patients as well.
That's a lovely answer. And you say that you're not a special case, but I think you do really come across as a special person. I think you're someone that we've met previously, and you're someone that we've talked about a lot. You come across as very strong, very articulate, and I'm really grateful to you to come and talk to us today about a topic that's really hard to talk about. But I can tell that the reason you want to do it is because you want to create positive change.
Yeah.
So thank you for your time.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here, because I really want I hope from these interviews with Lad Bible that I can actually reach more victims and survivors, and let them know that there's someone out there who understands you, and there's someone out there in a position to help who is trying to help. They don't have to be the ones to come forward and talk about it. I'll talk about it. I'll talk about the horrible things that happened to me, embarrass myself, but not embarrass myself, so that other people don't feel that they have to come forward unless they feel comfortable to. It's not for the trolls.
Should we give a little, I think that's, yeah.
Sorry.
Thank you, Kate.